You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, pay attention. I got asked, hey, Mac, I've heard those pieces, and I've heard them separately. Ned Seat, could you do me a favor? Could you play them in one sequence? I'd be happy to. So back to back to back to back. It's two parts, four segments. Ned Seat, Crossroads, produced by Matt Morgan. Coming up right now.
Ned Seat, a 67-year-old retired track foreman for the B&O Railroad, left his small hometown of Reed City, Michigan, and made the long trip to Quantico, Virginia. The National Museum of the Marine Corps had opened several years before, and Ned was looking forward to seeing it, but that wasn't the reason for Ned's trip. He had been called to Washington on the orders of the Secretary of the Navy because of something that had happened in Vietnam nearly 45 years before. I'm Matt Morgan, and this is Crossroads. Two combat vets, one mic, and a few war stories. Here, Ned talks with author and actor Ben Bush, a Marine combat veteran of Iraq.
You can't judge apple by looking at a tree. You can't judge honey by looking at the bee. You can't judge a daughter by looking at the mother. You can't judge a book by looking at the cover. Oh, can't you see?
My father was in the Marine Corps in World War II. And he was a radio operator. He strung line on Guadalcanal and various islands. And I really looked up to that and his friends. Some of his friends were World War II Marines. And they would discuss at the table, you know, some of the things that occurred and happened. They had pictures that they brought back from World War II. And it was pretty neat. So I thought, well, gee, you know. So I joined the Marine Corps in June of 62 after high school, and I flew to San Diego, California for recruit training.
And what was your first post after you graduated?
First post after I graduated, I had a machine gun and rifleman's MOS. I was selected for personal appearance and physical abilities to go to C school. It's where you're trained to be a security guard on America's warships. I was assigned to the aircraft carrier with the CVS 33, the USS Kearsarge, and the home port was Long Beach, California, and we sailed out of there in 1963, and we went out in the Marianas, and they had the Mercury space program then, and I was privileged to be part of the team that picked up Gordon Cooper, the astronaut, on that. It splashed down in the ocean. It was a pretty neat experience, and it was quite an experience being on a ship. It's pretty neat. I was waiting for orders, and I was in Marine Barracks in Hawaii. I was main gate sentry, and then I was got orders for First Recon, Camp Del Mar, California.
And you went back for training there.
Yeah, we had rubber boat training every morning. We'd take seven-man rubber boats out in the surf. And San Onofre had 8, 9, 10-foot waves out there. Sometimes it's hard to get that rubber boat out there. And I remember one time that I got stuck under the boat, and I was almost ready to drown, but then my feet touched bottom, and I got out from under it. And it was quite an experience, and we used to run 5 miles in the morning on the beach, a hangover or not. Sometimes you'd be running along, guys would be throwing up from drinking wine or beer, and just keep running in the sand. And then I went to Mountain Leadership School at in Pickle Meadows in Bishop, California, Sierra Nevadas, and we learned two-party climbing with pitons. Like, you see these people that crawling up, climbing ropes in Everest, you know, and they're all guided. Well, we had pitons, and if they had a guy belaying for you, another Marine, and sometimes you'd have to balance climb a cliff 90 feet with no climbing ropes or pitons, and that was kind of hairy, but it's part of your training. And Recon would use the worst terrain to train in because that would be the least route that the enemy would expect you to come in, so we always trained in the most rugged, inaccessible terrain.
And you see some incredible terrain there. I actually trained in Pickle Meadows, too, years later.
Wow.
94-94, our favorite hill.
And it's survival training where you go a week without food, you have to find your own stuff.
Right. And how long were you with Recon at that point?
Probably about 9 months. And then I got orders and I went to Cuba.
And what was the mission in Cuba at that time?
For a while I was a main gate sentry there for the workers coming across from Cuba for the day workers. I had to check their IDs and do random searches for weapons, anything concealed, and maintain that guard position, and sometimes they had to be in the guard towers, and had observation binoculars. And then I was assigned to the brig. I was a brig turnkey, and then I was the brig clerk doing reports for the Colonel Walker, Cole Steel Walker. He was a Marine Raider, World War II, and they were running out of ammo, and I think it was on Macon, and they fixed bayonets, and they routed the Japanese soldiers. And I worked for him, and he was one heck of a inspiration. He was a good Marine officer, full colonel.
And you got that job because they found out you could type.
Yeah, they found out I could type 50, 60 words a minute without error, so I got that job in the brig. It's one of the best jobs I had. Easy job.
And right after that?
Right after that, I got orders to go to Marine Corps Supply Center, Albany, Georgia. And I was there for probably 5-6 months. I played football on a Marine Corps football team. I was a middle linebacker. And I lifted weights. That's all I did on my spare time was I didn't go to town drink with the other Marines or anything. I just lifted. Had some guys that just lifted weights. Power lifting. I started in Cuba. I could bench 450 pounds. And I was pretty good size. I just enjoyed that.
Exactly why they gave you that machine gun.
Probably.
Yeah. It was the M60 back then, and that's where you became a...
Yeah, I got orders to FMF, and I had to report to the sergeant major of the base at Marine Corps Supply Center, Albany. And he says, well, Seth, I've got bad news. I know you got less than a year to do, but you got orders to go to Vietnam. He says, I'm sorry. And I said, I'm not sorry. That's what I joined up for. I joined up if I had to fight for my country. I said, it's no big deal. And then I got on a C-130 and flew to Okinawa, Japan, and started out at Camp Swab with Company K, 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines. I was assigned to be a machine gunner, and I'd never even seen an M-60. I was familiar with 30 calibers and 50s. But it was an experience. First thing they told me was take care of it. It cost $1,800. And I have to run, we'd done a 25-mile force march, and the last 2 miles, they decided they would show their gusto, and they had to run. I had to run with that 26-pound machine gun. That was hard, but I had an energy bar, and my canteens always kept sake wine, so I drink sake to keep me going.
Well, we couldn't do that when I was at Camp Schwab, but we just lacked ambition.
We couldn't do it, but we snuck it.
It's funny that, you know, they tell you how much things cost, because in the Marine Corps there's so little money for anything that an 1,800
weapon. Yeah, they're the only organization in the military that gives back money. I can never figure that out, you know, that... They don't demand the best to get a lot. We had a lot of hand-me-downs in Vietnam, the equipment, and we were happy to get what we could get.
I was still carrying canvas shelter halves and wearing, the equipment from basically the Korean War in the 90s.
Right.
It's because there wasn't anything wrong with it.
No, it's serviceable. Use it.
Well, what did you know about Vietnam by the time you'd gotten to Okinawa and knew that you were heading there?
Well, I knew that they had a Operation Starlight where I think units of the 2nd and 7th Marines really got into it with the VC. They were involved in a fight with, I think it was upwards of 500, 600 Viet Cong on the beach And it turned out to be quite a battle, and I talked to some of the guys in the machine gun squad that were involved in that that had rotated home. But that's about all I knew about it. It was very little. I knew that we were going there, and we took, after we trained there for a few months, we went over on a troop carrier, like in the olden times, and it was a big Navy transport vessel for Marines. We had 3rd Battalion, 4th Marine, we had a whole battalion on that ship.
Did you actually do a beach landing, or did you?
Yeah, we did. Actually, we went down to cargo, and that's like they did in World War II. There were these nets they threw over the side, and I remember having my machine gun with strapped to my backpack, full marching pack of gear and rations, the shelter halves, everything, and climbing over the side into a mic boat, and then we landed in a Perfume River banks at Wei, the old imperial capital of South Vietnam. And then we set up shelter halves. So we boarded trucks in Wei, and then we six-bys, and we set up shelter halves in Phu Bai. It was just a little tent camp. They didn't have any accommodations at all, you know, screened in hooches, you know, built out of Pi Square. They didn't have nothing like that. Just pitched shelter halves. And then the next day we started running squad patrols, platoon patrols.
At that time, Wei wasn't a place that people knew as a huge battle. It hadn't happened yet.
No, it hadn't happened. That was before that was the late 65, 1965 I got over there. And then I was over there through August of 66.
What was it like when you first reached Vietnam? What was your first impression of the place?
First impression was it was a beautiful country, but it was hot. Very, very hot. And the temperature in the afternoon, well, after 10 o'clock in the morning, it was always over 100 degrees. And it was humid. Right. Even being young and being in shape, it's a little difficult breathing with all your equipment.
Did you move from Phu Bai into different territory, or you pretty much stay in that area for the rest of your tour?
Well, we stayed in that area for about a month, and then we went on a combat mission, search and destroy. We flew out of there to go up north in the Sea Knight helicopters, Marine Corps assault helicopters, where you could get almost a platoon in one of them, at least two, three squads. And then you'd land where you were supposed to go for a search and destroy, either as a blocking mission or set up ambushes or patrols, whatever you're supposed to be doing.
And that was more jungle terrain than
that. That was jungle terrain, some open, but mostly triple canopy with streams and a lot of wildlife running around, monkeys and birds, and just like you see in the movies, a lot of different noises.
What did you think of the jungle?
Well, I liked the jungle for one reason. You could always get a position to where you had protection. There was always some kind of giant tree and triple canopy. It'd be hard for them to get a mortar round through it. And you had a lot of cover and concealment where you could conceal your machine gun, and you weren't out on open terrain like the troops have to deal with now, where it's flat, and you can be seen easily, and if somebody's in a rock pile or something, they can ambush these guys now. And or if you're fighting in buildings, which we didn't do, you have to clean out every building one by one. We didn't have to have that. We had good cover and concealment in a jungle. The only time you had a big problem is if you were on the move and then the enemy spots you first.
Now you could both hide, I guess, with that scenario.
Right.
A lot of times you had to go recover recon units that had been
lost.
Yeah,
we went on a couple of missions where we went on these hills, and it was very sad. Sometimes we had to fight our way up, and sometimes we didn't. And we would recover dead bodies from force recon that would be discovered, because they're armed good, but their mission is not to tip off your position or get involved in a firefight, because the enemy has more numbers and superiority in fire on their weapons, so you don't really stand a chance. But that was kind of a sad deal, and that was basically one of the reasons I got out of recon years ago, because I wanted to be in an infantry ground outfit where there are big superiority in numbers and a lot of firepower. Fuel marching pack, which weighed probably 60 pounds when it's full of your rations and extra ammo. The machine gun was 26 pounds with a 100-round salt pouch. Maximum rate of fire is 550 rounds a minute, and it would max effective range is 1,100 meters. If you could see him, you can kill him with it, and I had good eyesight. It was a lot of weight, 3 canteens of water, and you better use it sparingly, because in some place you run out, you're done. You have to have water up there because of the heat. And if you find water, they have iodine tablets. You mix what's called halazone. You mix it with your canteens, and every day you take your malaria pill, and if you don't take it, you're going to get it. I've seen other guys who didn't take their green malaria pills, and they ended up in sick bay in the rear.
You probably had times where you couldn't get resupply, and you're cut off, and you didn't have any fresh water. What happened?
You just go without. You go on reserved energy. And I was in one battle where we didn't get resupply, but when we went in there, we had a lot of ammo, and we were in there for 4 days, and you run out of water after the first day and a half, and eventually they did drop some supplies.
Now, sometimes you couldn't get your wounded out, you couldn't get your dead out.
They didn't. They had a recon for Operation Hastings, and it showed not that much enemy action, but when we landed there, at one helicopter was shot down and rotor blades was cutting people in half when they were turning. And the helicopter I was in, the Sea Knight, it either got connected with the other helicopter and knocked the rotors off about 60 feet above the ground. We had what's called a hard landing, and it come down real hard. And they went out of there, and they were the North Vietnamese were firing at us, and then we went by this bunker hospital where a corpsman was treating a wounded, and he had an SKS close to him, and one of my fire team leaders, Randy Gerald, I'll never forget him, from Texas. The next month he got killed on Operation Prairie. He was a wonderful Marine. He had ice cubes running in his veins, and nothing affected him. But he told that corpsman, you know, he mentioned with his rifle, don't go for it.
The Vietnamese corpsman.
North Vietnamese corpsman, you know. He was in his hospital, was treating one of the wounded North Vietnamese soldiers. So when he reached for it, and Randy shot him, and I knew right away that we were going to be in deep trouble, because if you're there and there's a hospital here, I mean, how many people they got for security guarding this place? And there were stockpiles of ammo and mortar rounds, artillery. There was just all kinds of weapons just piled right up for use. So we got all the men organized, and we dug in on the side of that hill, basically on the top of it, and we made a 360-degree perimeter of fighting holes. And I set the machine gun up at a main avenue approach. Probably this trail was probably 6, 7, 8 feet wide, heavily used. And then that night they blew the whistles and the bugles, and they assaulted our positions. And we were involved in a big firefight.
Now, how long did it take for the U.S. to get you back out of that position? That wasn't a stay and hold. That was supposed to just be a clearing mission, right?
Right. We were supposed to be the blocking force. 3-4 was. But the way it worked out was we landed right in near the headquarters of the 324th B North Vietnamese division. We landed actually over a full regiment of North Vietnamese. We were outnumbered 10 to 1.
How long were you there?
Almost 4 days. And during the day, when we could, we run patrols.
And you had two helicopters down your LZ.
In the LZ, yeah. And the pictorial War on Vietnam, Life magazine has these books on Vietnam. And I've got the book that shows these helicopters on the ground. Hmm. They took photographs of them. It was a very, very hard-fought, bloody battle, that one.
How were you able to get your wounded out?
They had some medevacs come in towards our headquarters in the rear of the perimeter, but I was in a forward position, and they threw some of them out. They didn't think that it was going to be a big operation, so they didn't have enough body bags. A lot of the Marines that were KIA laid out there, and they put shoulder ass over them. But after a couple of days, they started really bloat and turn black. It was pretty sad, and you have to go back to get ammunition or some water or something, and you see this. You know, it's pretty hard when you see that.
What did you think of, you were fighting NVA, the official troops, not the VC, which are in the south. What did you think about them? I mean, they're your enemy.
Well, one thing about them, they're like Marines. When they're told to do something, they do it. And when they attack, they attack in numbers, large numbers. And they've got modern weapons. They've got AK-47s, top of the line, Russian made, some Chinese. They've got SKSs, and they have 51 caliber Chi-Com machine guns, and most of them are on wheels. They wheel them up in position, and when they open up, especially at night, they use green tracers. They don't use the reds like I do, like we had in our 4-1. There were green. It was something. And then we were involved in a deal where we were on a patrol, and they ambushed with anti-aircraft guns, and they were cutting down 5-inch trees. They were blowing pieces. They were hitting Marines and just blowing them nearly up, cutting them in half. It was quite an experience. Scary.
What did it feel like to move against that?
It's like any Marine. You do what you have to do. You look out for your buddies. You try to destroy the enemy to the best of your ability, which I did. And I was efficient, proficient. I was a good shot. And usually the enemy tries to get the skipper, the radio man, or the machine gun, or whatever comes first in their sight. So over there I was wounded twice. I was wounded once. We were being overrun, and my machine gun, I got shot in the hand. And he told me he was shot in the hand, and I said, Frank, take a compress and put it on your left hand, and shoot with that. I said, we're almost being overrun at this point. And he says, well, they blew the front of the gun up. And I said, well, then come on back to me. And he came back to me. Frank West was his name. He was from Virginia. He had a little rebel tattoo on his arm. He was a little scrawny kid, but he was He was very, very highly motivated. Frank always wanted to carry the gun, always wanted a gun, this and that. Well, I trained him, and he did good. And then, of course, like all machine gunners, they get killed or wounded. He came back to my position. I give him my M14 with a full automatic and selector. Told him to go back to the corpsman. He gave me his 45, and which I don't know why he did that. Made that move. 45 wouldn't be any good. But anyway, I crawled out under fire and retrieved the machine gun and put a poncho out on the trail. And I was out of the fighting hole then and trying to piece it together to get it to work. And I couldn't do it. It wouldn't work.
This is nighttime also.
This is the nighttime. They had
complete dark.
Some flares, and the squad next to me was there, and he said, well, I'm trying to give you some time, Ned. You know, I'm trying to give you some time. Well, they fixed bayonets, and they were, when they were, NVA was coming up, and they were so close that they were using vertical butt strokes and stuff like boot camp, and they were stabbing them with their bayonets and to hold them off. Well, the good thing that happened was they fired a mortar round, the Gooks did, and I got wounded in the back and a knee, and Bill Hutton was wounded by the same mortar round, but he was able to keep fighting. And then the squad leader, Big Red, he had an M79. He told me to hurry up because he couldn't hold him off too much longer. And that fires a rifle grenade, M79. They called it the blooper. Now they have it mounted underneath their M4s, is that what it is? AR.
203s.
Yeah. Now they have them mounted. And so, fortunately, there was a machine gun on a flank position, an M60, that would only fire a single shot. So they passed it over to me. I took that apart and was cleaning a bunch of parts. And, well, if it's firing single shots, got to be the buffer isn't working right. So I took the buffer out of my machine gun, put it in the other, and plus I put a bunch of other parts in there needed. The operating rod spring was screwed up, and the operating rod spring guide in the machine gun was screwed up, so I replaced all that. And then I made one good machine gun, and they were massing on the trail, and I fired from a prone position and until they were piled up, and then I was kneeling, firing it offhand, and then finally, because of the enemy casualties, I was firing standing up under fire, and they said I had killed over 100 of them. And then there was another instance where I crawled out on enemy fire when a corpsman was treating 8 wounded Marines from a squad they'd sent out a day earlier, and Corman said it was impossible to reach a wounded Marine, which was Corporal Bob Blake. He was shot through the heel, and I think the NVA left him out there so that some Marine would go out there to retrieve him and end up, you know, being shot by the sniper. But I disregarded what the Corman said. And then I crawled out there about 50 feet or so, I don't know. It's on the opposite trail that they had. And I crawled out there and I drug him back and they fired a round through my helmet. And it went through my body armor. Then was nothing but some nylon plates. It wasn't anything like they got now, but it's better than nothing. And went through there and then it went in the bottom of my tailbone. I've got a small hole in there and still there. And I got Corporal Blake back, and I did locate and kill the sniper because the muzzle blast in the bush and almost cut him in half. I was kind of upset then about the whole deal. That's the only time I abused a machine gun. I fired probably 50 rounds. I just blew him right to pieces. But that's, you know, it was tough. It was hot, and at night it was... all that fighting, I really didn't have time to even be scared, you know. After we go back from the operations, to the rear to recover, then you get scared and you have nightmares, and then you're really scared. But during the fighting, you don't seem, I wasn't too much, hardly ever afraid while I was fighting, and I don't think my friends were either, the guys that were my flank security. I don't think they had time to be. You just don't. You react.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Took in that major fight where you were wounded, where you constructed a single fighting machine gun out of two in the dark.
Yeah.
And you were there for 4 days, two down helicopters, very little reinforcement or resupply. What happened then? They just pulled the unit out?
Well, we had 80% casualties. We had killed over 900 North Vietnamese regulars, my rifle company, K Company, part of the 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines. And they sent another battalion to relieve us. And they thought that when I was on a forward position, they thought I was dead. They were going to do a body recovery on me because of the night before. And then 1st Lieutenant Dave Richland come over there. He walked from the headquarters to the rear of the hill, and he said, it's time to go, Corporal Seath. And so at that morning when I finally woke up, I don't know if I was subconscious or conscious or what. I know I was wounded, and I went out on the trail where all these bodies were piled up from the North Vietnamese regulars. I recovered two AK-47s and probably 10-15 magazines. I only had about 70 rounds left on the feed plate of my M60 machine gun, and I knew this was going to be my last day. I didn't have any more ammo. The wounded troops or pulled them out, and I didn't have anybody the night before as an A gunner to feed me ammo. I had to do everything myself, and thank God I had over 500 rounds of ammo stacked up there in belts. Otherwise, that would have been it for all of us. They'd annihilated my rifle company if I didn't stop them. But anyway, on the way to the helicopter, the Lieutenant Richwine, he noticed some things, and then we were in a little clearing to get to this medevac Huey, and he noticed some apertures, and he says, "What's that?" And he pointed, and I said, "Richwine, those are enemy bunkers." I said, "If we don't move it," I said, "they're going to kill us." I said, "Don't stop, move." I said, "They're waiting for a main body behind us, and then they're going to set off an ambush." I said, "They're going to let us go," and he started dwindling around and dwelling around there, and I grabbed his hand and I grabbed and put it on my cartridge belt, and I run through there with a gun. And then in the last bunker, there was movement, so I fired my machine gun through the aperture. I used all my ammo, 50, 60 rounds I had left, and I was out of ammo. And then I went another probably 50, 60 yards, and there was the Huey gunship. And him and I got on there, and there was four or five casualties on there. And then we flew back to Dung Ha, and that was it for that. And then they had a ceremony the next day, and it was pretty sad. They had one or two guys stand in a squad, and then they had M14 rifles with bayonets fixed in the ground with helmets on them and a few marching packs for... You look down a squadron, and there's nobody there. That was hard. It's hard now. Excuse me.
What happened to Corporal Blake, the man you saved?
I think Corporal Blake told him what I did, and that's how come the Bronze Star caught up with me with a Combat V.
So he made it home.
He made it. Yeah, he was shot through the heel. His bottom part of the heel was mostly gone. The sniper had a regular Mosin, Nagant, or whatever you call them, with a 7.62x54R, the big round, the 200 grain sniper round. He got it. But yeah, it was. They said I saved a lot of lives on that battle by doing what I did. Could have been an easy thing. Smart thing to do would probably just to leave all that piled up machine gun parts and junk laying there and go back to the rear and tell me, look, we can't fight no more. But I just, I realized what would happen if I didn't get these working. We might not have made it.
When you were there, what did you think about home? Think about Reed City, Michigan?
I had a girlfriend. I wrote her Dear John a letter because I didn't think I was coming back. After the first few battles there, I didn't think I was going to make it, being a machine gunner. And then later on, a team leader ended up machine gun because machine gunners, you get shot, wounded. And I didn't think a lot about it. I think some about it, but I tried not to think about it because I didn't think I was going back to it. I really didn't. It would be the consequences and the odds against me. Every time we get in a firefight, we usually outnumbered, outgunned, and everything. I think God had his hand on my right shoulder to guide me through it. And I had good men, and I had good flanking fire teams to guard the machine gun.
You probably weren't thinking a whole lot about politics of the war at the time, but... what were your feelings in Vietnam, knowing that America really wasn't paying a whole lot of attention to what was happening to you there?
Well, as fighting men, we didn't appreciate their attitude, and we didn't appreciate what they were doing. But now I think, well, you know, they're mostly right, because why sacrifice all these men for nothing? For a political ploy and paranoia about how communism is going to spread, so we'll just send a bunch of men over there. But we're not going to really win because we don't want China and Russia to be involved. But to save face, we'll let all these men die. And then we'll pull them out when it's convenient for us. When they had poor leadership, McNamara, they had a sandbox with all the military units and everything posted there and the little toy soldiers in there. And they're running a frickin' war from calling it in from the White House, which is a bunch of bullshit. They're incompetent. And 53,800 and some men are on the wall now because of their incompetency. That's what I think of it. But I was proud to be a Marine, and I was proud to do my part for this country, right or wrong. You know, I did what I was told, and if they didn't have people like my people, where would this country be if they got into a situation where they had to defend it?
You actually sat with Vietnamese. You actually were on a combined action team.
Right.
Yeah, and in a village, defending a village, essentially.
Right. Yeah, I was part of a CAC unit. I've got a combined action ribbon at home on my ribbon bars.
Tell me about that village, though. Your impressions as an American.
Well, the village is total function was to feed, was to grow rice, crops, vegetables, feed themselves to survive, and they had water buffalo to do their plowing and that. They had a 1-point plow, and the people, they're kind people. They always had a smile on their face, you know, even if they didn't have hardly anything, they would offer it to you because they knew that the Viet Cong, or not, it wasn't North Vietnamese that were taxing them where I was at. And we protected them and we trained them and everybody did to the best of their ability. They were good people.
What do you think happened to that village after you left?
Maybe some of them were sent for, was taken over, and they were sent in for re-education. That's what happened to a lot of them.
Hmm.
Into the communist propaganda machine.
Would you like to go back to that village?
I haven't thought about it too much. Kind of like to forget that war.
Hmm.
Because it's a lot of painful experiences. You know, you remember about things, and it's just like walking in the next room, and it's there. It's like you never left. That's a bad thing about things. Your brain processes information that's only pertinent and true with information. Your brain doesn't retain it. But when you're involved in a war, when it's your life and the life of your comrades and friends, you have to really, really think about it, and it's like it's printed on my brain yet.
When you're walking through you live by a beautiful stream in Michigan, right, where you built your house, and when you're walking through that forest, do you sometimes think back to the forests of that war? Does it come back to you?
Never. So I'm always have peace of mind walking in the forest because there's birds singing, and you got beautiful leaves and the trees, and the calmness of the forest, and no noise. I very, very seldom think about it. Just the only time I think about it is to have a bad dream. That's all. I don't really relate to it anymore, but I'd kind of like to go back there someday, Ben, just to visit, you know.
When you were there, did you sometimes have the same feelings that this is a beautiful forest?
Oh, it was a beautiful country, yeah. We always thought it was beautiful, and especially on Highway 1 and everything. And if you ever go up there in a convoy or something, there's a lot of mountains, and you got the South China Sea, and you got these beautiful trees, banana trees, and different types. And the train's beautiful. But one thing about the train when we're on a military operations, a lot of times you're walking along and you see a jungle vine stretched across the trail. And you look at it, and it'll pass the vines wire to a trip grenade, and you'll have an artillery round shell pointed down cone shape, which wipe everybody out. But you had to be very careful at all times. You had to be paying attention to what you're doing. You were hunted. Sometimes you were the hunter. A lot of times you were the hunter, they were the hunted, and vice versa.
When you got back after those firefights, and you had missing people in your ranks, how long did you have to deal with that? Because you had to go right back out again.
You do the best you can with them. It was a sad situation.
Well, you had to educate your lieutenants who had even less training. They were shot.
Yeah, we wouldn't let them get us killed. No, we had to. They were gung-ho and want to take the hill, and just like in the movies, you know, get everybody in a herd, try to take the hill and get everybody killed. That's not going to happen.
You had to teach them how to use
maps.
You had to teach them how to call for fire.
I had to, because of my recon experience, teach them how to read a map, to call in artillery. If they want to do this or that, and we know the enemy's there, let's call in 105s at least, level that hill, and then go up there and clean it up.
How many times were you operating where you didn't have artillery support at all?
Night ambushes.
What were those nights like, waiting?
You don't move. You barely breathe. You don't make any noise. You make any noise, they got you. You just wait. You stay awake and wait. It's the anticipation.
What is it like to see people moving at night?
Well, one night, we were out on a night ambush, and it was squad size. So in other words, there was three fire teams plus our fire team. So we're looking at 20 Marines. We were in kind of an online ambush, but in our rear we put a fire team for rear guard. You always do that. You always guard your flank and your rear, otherwise you open yourself up for annihilation. And there was this troop movement, and they were like in a column of threes, and we were going to send it off, and I bumped the staff sergeant, and I went like that. And so we held off. Well, they just, for 10 minutes, there was a line of NVA just kept on moving and moving. There must have been 300 in there. If we just set that off, it would have been instant death. That was scary when they were marching by and we could see their shadows. And we never opened up because that would have been the end of us.
How did you know that there were that many?
It's a shadow and a shadow of column of threes. You could just see them over the. It was a moonlight night, and you could see the shadows, and you could hear them marching, and you could just you knew there was. We were outnumbered, and so we didn't set that ambush off.
What did the jungle sound like at night?
Sometimes it's pretty quiet. When it quiets down, it's when the enemy's around, because these birds, they don't make any noise, because. They know that they're discovered, so they use their cover and concealment. So when it's real, real quiet, you know the enemy's around. That's when you know you're probably going to get hit.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer. But I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure out of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there. With folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Remember that story you were telling about the DMZ op, how hot it was, and walking around that mountain in circles.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that probably happened more often than you'd think.
No, that was only the one time, and then I noticed that we were moving in a circle, and it was very, very hot, and my field marching pack and that M60 was getting so heavy, my legs were almost ready to buckle. The first sergeant was out there on that. First Sergeant Ohm, he was a machine gunner in the Korean War. He was just fantastic leader. And he was kind to the troops. He didn't bully anybody or anything, and he's a smart man. He come by and want me to take the machine gun. See, he says, looks like you need a little help. Let me take the gun. And I says, I'm all right, First Sergeant. He said, come on, let me take it for a little bit. So I handed it to him. He was just happy he could be a machine gunner again, you know, being a high-ranking First Sergeant. He's going to be a machine gunner. But I got my stuff together in about 10 minutes. But anyway, the platoon commander, 3rd Platoon and Weapons Platoon commander, First Lieutenant Richline come over to me with a map. He says, I think I'm, yeah, you're lost. I said it like that, too, and I didn't say sir or nothing. It's about ready to drop. And I showed him how to orientate the compass on the landmarks that were circled in these hills and how to shoot an azimuth on these positions, back azimuth, and told him we're here. He says, oh, good. He says, now I can get us to where we got to go. So taught him how to do that. And then a few days later, there was a big clearing, and he was down from this big hill we were occupying. And he was standing up, and they cut loose with an AK-47, and all the vines around him were dropping. And he was standing there looking at his map. And he was about 6'3", 6'4", a good big target. And I told him, you know, to get down, they're shooting at you. And then I grabbed him by the cartridge belt, which he had his pistol belt, and I pulled him, just grabbed him, and I was in shape, and I pulled him right down the ground. He said, what did you do that for? And I said, to save you. Oh, and he's still got his mind on the map. And I said, well, you do this and that. And I says, these grids are 1,000 meters square. And I says, and we're here, as you know, and you want to call in artillery over there. And I says, you grid left, you grid right, and where that intersects is where your artillery number is going to be. And, okay. Had to teach him one time. From then on, he had it down pat. Very intelligent young man.
But it's something that's interesting about how briefly officers were trained before the war. They were sent, they called them, what, 14-day wonders or 22-day wonders?
Yeah, they were 22-day wonders, and I asked one second lieutenant. He had a big smile on his face. He was a good kid, and I think he was probably my age. I was older than when I went over there. I was turned 21 over there, and he might have been 20 maybe, just out of college. I asked him about his experiences. Well, basically, they train us to be, you know, leadership cannon fodder. I said, well, you have to learn something here. And I says, and what did the first sergeant and the sergeant major tell you? He said, listen to the NCOs and we'll all make it. And I says, they're right. You listen to us. We have the experience. We'll work with you. We won't work against you unless you get too gung-ho. We're not going to do this. We're going to all get together as a herd and run uphill and get slaughtered. What we're going to do is we're going to teach you how to read a map and a compass, and we're going to have you pound the hell out of that hill with artillery, and then we'll go up there when we think we can, and we'll mop it up. I said, that's the way we're going to do it.
What did you hate most about the deployment to Vietnam?
What did I hate about it?
What did you hate most about it? Like, even now, you can remember.
Well, loss of troops is what I hated about it.
Was there any time to mourn after these engagements where you'd lose people you knew really well?
Well, clean your weapon, you think about that. You always try to think about something else, because if you think about what really happened to these people and you don't have them to help you anymore or for you to help them, it'll break you. It could break you mentally. So you have to concentrate on other tasks, like you clean a gun, you clean a machine gun, you eat something, or you drink something, or you check your ammo, or you check your men's ammo. You're always doing something so you don't think about it.
Did that catch up with you at some point?
Well, at the end it did. I drank too much beer, just was kind of wild. I never got in trouble with the law, but when I got out, I bought a new GTO. I went to work for GM. I had a good job, and just pretty wild. Kind of try to run away from it. A lot of vets did. Because there wasn't any services for us. There wasn't any give and take. There was no counseling. There was nothing. They didn't have anything to help us with our post-traumatic stress disorder like they did the guys in World War II. We were sort of like the Korean War veterans in the Forgotten War. They didn't pay any attention to us. There wasn't services available. Unless you were actually still in a naval hospital or something when you got medical attention. And they did get some counseling. There was some counselors in Philadelphia when I was wounded, that were counseling you to see if you're all right to go on liberty and stuff, and they were good.
How long before you got back to Michigan?
I was in a hospital about maybe a month, and I was involuntarily extended in Vietnam by Act of Congress. In 1966, in June, I was supposed to be out of the Marine Corps. First Sergeant called Bennett, and I, and Hutton, and a few other corporals to the command tent and headquarters tent back in Dung Ha, and said that he had bad news for us, and, you know, we were concerned about our people back home. And he says, no, he says, you've been involuntarily extended by Act of Congress for 6 months. This is after we'd done our 4 years. We're coming to be up. And then, of course, in the next month, I got wounded twice. Actually, I earned 3 Purple Hearts. I have on my military awards, I have a Purple Heart with 2 stars, which is wound 3, designated for 3 wounds at 3 different times. And it's kind of ironic. I was working for GM. I was a frame inspector back in the end of almost 1967, and they sent me Purple Heart in a cardboard box. You know, so all my other medals, you know, my Vietnam Cross of Gallantry, and there was Good Conduct Medal, eligible for Second Award. They sent me a Good Conduct Medal, which was really neat because it was a World War II type. Mm-hmm. Had the rifle above the ribbon, and they're discontinued. And I opened up this box, you know, and it was from the U.S. government. I didn't know what it was, and there's my medals laying in it.
There's your ceremony.
Yeah, the Bronze Star Combat V, Marine Corps recruiter, awarded that in his office, which they had a little ceremony. My dad was there. My dad was a sergeant in the state police. And he was there, and some other guys were there. And they even put it in the newspaper for GM. I showed it in there. It's pretty neat. But I never figured I'd get anything from that war. I didn't. I was just happy to be alive and partying and out, you know.
Take a long time to settle down after you got back?
Quite a long time. Yeah. I was married for 6 months. It didn't work out, and it was too soon. It was kind of a deal where my parents and her parents in the subdivision where we lived figured, well, that'd be the best thing for Ned if he'd get married. Oh, that'll straighten him up. He won't drink so much beer, and raised so much hell. And but it didn't work out. But thank God there was no children, and it was only for 6 months. And it took a lot of years to settle down, but thank God I had good common sense, and I was raised right. I didn't get in trouble with the law or anything. Mm-hmm. I was a good citizen. I worked, and I worked hard, and I played hard. I had a nice GTO I bought from Pontiac Motors. I remember buying it, $3,200, 400 cubic inch motor with a Holley quadrajet, Hurst 4-speed. It would move. I enjoyed that car. That took my mind off problems that occurred from my experiences in the war in Vietnam.
Did it help to be in the open going fast?
It did. I remember one time, it's New Year's Eve, 1967. I was going down the freeway past Pontiac on I-75. And back then, it was in the winter, and you had studded tires. You know, all your tires were studded. And the GTO back then had positive traction. And I was doing 105 on the freeway, drinking beer and everything, partying down. And there was nobody on the road. This is about 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. Nobody on the road, so I wasn't risking anybody else. I was just reckless. And way behind me, I seen a red light, you know, bubble. And I didn't think anything of it. So I kept going and kept going, and I must have went 5 miles. And he finally caught up to me. Had one of those Ford Interceptors and big motor. So he caught up to me, and he hit the siren and everything in the spotlight. So I pulled over, and he says, "What is your problem? Why are you going so fast?" I says, "Well, I'm trying to forget the war, and I was partying." And I looked over, and at the state trooper was my friend, Lawrence Brown. He was from the UP. We both lived together when my dad was stationed in St. Ignace. It was Lawrence. He just shook his head, and he says, "I don't want you speeding anymore." He wrote me a ticket. He wrote me a ticket for 105 in a 70. And I went to see the judge in Pontiac. He said, "I don't know what your problem is, but you got to straighten up. That's going too fast." And I remember the ticket back then even. It was almost a week's pay. It was $85. And I think I made $120 a week working for GM. Hmm. And I learned my lesson. I slowed down then. For a while.
Is there anyone in particular you remember most that you've lost? And someone who maybe you're still in touch with?
Well, I've kind of lost contact with all those guys, but Gene Bennett's a good friend of mine. He owned a trucking business. He lives in Arizona. Him and I fought together. He was in the next fighting hole. And also Bill Hutton, that was a national commander of the military, of the Purple Heart, contact with him. And every now and then I talk to General Richwind.
Yeah.
And, he's his friend. And I've talked to my company commander. He was awarded a Medal of Honor for this thing, for his leadership. And Colonel Mordrueski, his problem was, I think, is a lot of company commander. They lose a lot of men, they take it to heart, and they blame themselves. And actually, he went to a duty station, and he wasn't wearing his 13-star blue and white Medal of Honor ribbon, and they told him, "Well, you earned it, wear it." And he felt remorse because of losing all his men, over 80% casualties. I think there was maybe 11 or 12, 13 men out of 130 didn't have Purple Hearts. This one battle was horrendous. It was bad. But we did what we had to do, and we won. And we got out of there, and we left the battlefield with over 900 NVA dead and whatever else they drug off. I don't know.
Do you ever think about the men you killed?
I kind of do now. A lot of them were pretty young. I think a lot of those NVAs were only like 15, 16, some of them. And then you go through their things, you have to do that, and you check booby traps. You'd see the wall, whether pictures or loved ones, and that did, even then, at that time, it did make me sad. You know, I thought, well, this guy had somebody, but he's trying to kill you. So I never felt too sorry for any of them, because we were there, we had a mission, and it's them or you, you know. Somebody's going to walk away, somebody isn't, and I'm going to walk away. That was my attitude, and take as many of our men with me to walk away. But now I feel that it's too bad for their loss of life. They're trying to find their people now, and they're trying to give them a proper burial, and that's going to be hard to do where we operated. It's virtually impossible to find them.
We're still looking for ours, too. And
right.
For them, and we call it the Vietnam War. They call it the American War.
You can't blame them.
No, of course.
We're in their backyard, and they're still arguing over why.
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty obvious, you know.
Have you thought about returning to Vietnam now?
I was thinking maybe, you know, because I guess they're quite friendly with us, and I think everybody's kind of, the former Vietnamese Army people are kind of like to see us guys, and I guess everybody's getting along, and they're kind of helping. They're donating money to the wounded and helping people out and doing foundations for them you know, things. Yeah, I heard it also that your dollar goes a long ways over there. But, yeah, someday I'd like to go back there.
Is there something you specifically want to see?
Well, I'd like to go back up in the DMZ to some of the battlefields, but I know they're overgrown. Probably wouldn't be any terrain features that I would recognize anymore, but I'd like to go up on that hill. You really, when I all that fighting, I really didn't have time to even be scared, you know. But after we go back from the operations to the rear to recover, then you get scared and you have nightmares. And
what do you remember from that? Do you still have any of those dreams?
I've had a lot of them through the years, and I think the worst one, if you're talking nightmares, is they call me up and I got to go back, and they say you have to go back to Vietnam. It's bad. We need your help. You got experience. And then I get on this airplane to fly back, and it just freaks me out because I have to go back.
Well, I got to say thank you so much for spending some time sharing your memories and for your service.
And thank you, Ben, for your service in the Marine Corps as a Marine officer and fighting in the desert, my Iraq, and what you do for veterans now. You know, I'm very proud of you, and thank you for your service, and I hope I didn't bore anybody.
MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.